decorated in blazing jewel tones of red and green, blue and gold. They moved down a bronze-painted corridor and into an octagonal room full of downworlders. Chatter and laughter rose about them like a tide. Cordelia felt her heart flutter a bit. There was something about this night that felt dangerous, and not because she was in a room full of downworlders. The fact that none of them were making any attempt to hide it did make it seem somehow less worrisome. Vampires stalked by proudly, their faces gleaming in the electric light. Werewolves prowled the shadows in elegant evening dress. There was music coming from a string quartet standing on a raised cherrywood stage in the centre of the room. Cordelia glimpsed a handsome violin player with the gold-green eyes of a werewolf, and a clarinetist with auburn curls, his calves ending in the hard hooves of a goat. The walls were a deep blue, and massive gilt-framed paintings hung upon them, depicting scenes from mythology. At least Cordelia thought they were scenes from mythology. Usually when people were naked in paintings, she found, it was because the painter believed that the Greeks and Romans had no need or use for clothing, which Cordelia found puzzling, especially when the subjects were engaged in activities such as fighting minotaurs or wrestling serpents. Any shadow hunter knew that in battle, gear that covered your body was crucial. "I simply cannot see why one would wish to picnic in the nude," Cordelia said. "There would be ants in dreadful places." Anna laughed. "Cordelia, you are a breath of fresh air," she said, as a woman with dark hair bore down on them, carrying a silver salver. Her black hair was wrapped around an ivory comb hung about with silk peonies, and her embroidered gown was deep crimson. Glittering on the salver were crystal glasses filled with sparkling liquid. "Champagne," she said, and as she smiled, the glimmer of fang teeth appeared against her lower lip, a vampire. "Thank you, Lily," said Anna, taking a glass. Matthew did the same, and after a moment's hesitation, Cordelia followed. She had never had champagne, nor anything like it. According to her mother, ladies drank only sweet liquors like sherry and ratafia. Matthew downed his champagne in one swallow, placed the empty glass back on Lily's tray and took another. Cordelia lifted her glass as a dapper warlock with a ring of quills around his neck passed by, arm in arm with a blonde vampire in a garnet red frock. She was lovely and pale as new snow. Cordelia thought of the mundane women who paid to have their faces enameled white to preserve their youth and keep their fashionable pallor. They ought to just become vampires, she thought. It would be less expensive. "What's that little smile of yours?" Matthew inquired. "You look as if you're about to laugh." Cordelia took a sip of champagne. It tasted like airy bubbles, and regarded him archly. "What of it?" "Most girls would be afraid," he said. "I mean, not Anna or Lucy, but most."
"I don't frighten easily," said Cordelia.
"I'm beginning to sense that."
He glanced over at Anna and Lily. The vampire girl was laughing, her head close to Anna's.
"Anna can seduce anyone," Matthew said to Cordelia in a low voice. "Anyone at all. It's her talent."
"Not my only talent, I hope," said Anna, looking up as Malcolm Fade reappeared. He gestured to Lily with a dismissive wave. Lily flounced off in a swirl of silk.
"Hypatia wishes to see you, Anna," said Malcolm. "She has a friend visiting from out of town who has requested to meet you."
Anna gave a curling smile. "And this friend is visiting from where?"
"The seaside," said Malcolm.
"Do come. You know how Hypatia gets."
Anna dropped a wink to Cordelia and Matthew and turned to follow Malcolm down a passageway papered with damask wallpaper. They were quickly out of view.
"She's so beautiful," said Cordelia.
"Anna, I mean."
"Anna has a quality." Matthew raised a thoughtful eyebrow. "The French would call it jolie laide."
Cordelia knew French well enough to frown.
"Pretty ugly? She's not ugly."
It doesn't mean that, Matthew said. It means unusually pretty, oddly beautiful. It denotes having a face with character. His gaze travelled from the top of her hair to the tips of her shoes, like you have. He reached out to snag a glass of champagne off a passing tray as the handsome werewolf from the string quartet went by with a smile. Somehow Matthew had drunk the one he had and discarded it with impressive speed and discretion. He took a swallow of the new one and met Cordelia's eyes over the rim. Cordelia was not entirely sure how she felt about being called pretty ugly, but there were more important issues at hand. She didn't know when she would be alone again with Matthew. She said, "Do you remember how I asked you about your mother at the ball?" "I always enjoy thinking about my mother at these sorts of parties," he said. She took another swallow of champagne and tried to restrain a hiccup. "Your mother is the consul," she continued.
"I had noticed that, yes."
"And she is currently in Idris, where they are preparing to try my father." His eyes narrowed. "I thought..." He shook his head. A group of vampire ballerinas glanced over at them and giggled.
"Never mind. I think too much and I drink too much. That is always my problem."
"There is something I don't understand," said Cordelia. "Why haven't they tried my father with the mortal sword yet? Then they would have proof he's innocent."
Matthew looked faintly surprised. "Indeed, it makes little sense to possess a magical object that forces the holder to tell the truth if you aren't going to use it in criminal trials." The word criminal still shook Cordelia to the bone.
"We have very little information, but my brother does have school friends in Idris. He has heard they do not plan to use the mortal sword in the trial. Do you think you could convince your mother that they must?"
Matthew had procured another drink, possibly from a potted plant. He was watching her over the rim of the glass. Cordelia wondered how many people had seen Matthew grinning over a drink and failed to spot him watching them with those dark green eyes. "You're very upset about this, aren't you?" he said.
"It is my family," she said. "If my father is found guilty, we will not just lose him. We will be as the Lightwoods were after Benedict's death. Everything will be stripped from us. Our name will be disgraced."
"Do you care that much about disgrace?"
"No," said Cordelia. "But my mother and brother do, and I do not know if they would survive."
Matthew set his glass down on a marquetry side table. "All right," he said. "I will write to my mother in Idris."
The relief was almost painful. "Thank you," said Cordelia. "But have her write back to Lucy, please, at the Institute. I don't want my mother to see the reply before I do, in case she says no."
Matthew frowned. "My mother would not..." He broke off, looking past her to where Lily waved from the other end of the room. "That is Anna's signal," he said. "We must go." Cordelia felt a slight thrill of unease.
"Go where?"
"Into the heart of it all," said Matthew, gesturing toward the damask-papered corridor Anna had disappeared down before. "Brace yourself. Warlocks can be as tricky as fairies if they set their minds to it." Curious, Cordelia followed Matthew down the hall. Paper lanterns lit the way. At the very end of the passage was a cabinet of carved ebony, an array of curios spread out under glass. Matthew gave the glass a playful tap. The cabinet swung inward. Within was a golden grotto. The whole room gleamed, from the painted ceiling to the floor where the carpet shone as if it were flaxen tissue paper. There were giltwood tables holding all manner of treasures, clockwork birds inlaid with lapis and gold, gauntlets and blades of delicate fairy workmanship. A polished wooden box decorated with the symbol of an Ouroboros, a serpent biting its own tail, and an apple carved from a single ruby. At the very end of the room was a four-poster bed the size of Cordelia's whole bedroom at home, inlaid with copper and brass,
covered in dozens of cloth of gold cushions. Seated upon the edge of the bed, as if it were a throne, was a woman, a sleek warlock who seemed artfully shaped from enchanted materials, her skin mahogany, her hair bronze, her dress a shimmering gold. Cordelia hesitated upon the threshold. There were other people in the room besides the warlock woman, Malcolm Fade himself and Anna Lightwood, lounging alone on a conversation settee of walnut wood and gilt velvet, her long legs hooked over the slender wooden arms. Malcolm Fade smiled.
"Welcome, little shadow hunters. Few of your kind ever see the inner chamber of Hypatia Vex."
"Is she welcome, I wonder?" asked Hypatia with a cat-like smile. "Let her approach."
Cordelia and Matthew advanced together, Cordelia moving cautiously around the rococo chairs and tables, gleaming with gilt and pearls. Close up, the pupils of Hypatia Vex's eyes were the shape of stars, her warlock mark.
"I cannot say I care for the idea of so many Nephilim infesting my salon. Are you interesting?" Cordelia Carstairs.
Cordelia hesitated.
"If you have to think about it," said Hypatia, "then you're not."
"That hardly makes sense," said Cordelia. "Surely if you do not think, you cannot be interesting."
Hypatia blinked, creating the effect of stars turning off and on like lamps. Then she smiled.
"I suppose you may stay a moment."
"Good work, Cordelia," said Anna, swinging her legs off the edge of the settee. "Arabella, how are the drinks coming on?"
Cordelia turned to realize a fairy woman with tumbling blue and green hair was also in the room. She was standing in an alcove, partially hidden. Before her was a sideboard where she was mixing drinks. Her hands waved in midair like fronds in water, unstoppering decanters and crystal vials full of red liquid, and busily pouring them into a variety of goblets and flutes. Cordelia's eyes narrowed.
"Just ready, darling," Arabella said, and walked over to distribute drinks.
Matthew accepted a drink with alacrity. Cordelia noticed that Arabella walked with a rocking, unsteady gait, as if she were a sailor unaccustomed to treading on the land. When Arabella gave Anna her drink, Anna pulled Arabella into her lap. Arabella giggled, kicking up her French heels. Her legs were shockingly bare and covered in a faint iridescent pattern of scales. They flashed in the golden light like a rainbow.
A mermaid. So this was Hypatia's friend from the seaside.
They were a type of fairy rarely seen out of water, since their human legs caused them pain to walk on. Arabella noticed Cordelia's gaze and shrugged, shoulders moving fluidly beneath her heavy masses of blue and green hair.
"I have not been on land for many years. The last time I visited this ugly city, the Downworlders and Shadowhunters were trying to form the Accords. I was not much impressed with Nephilim then, and I have not been fond of Shadowhunters since. Still, exceptions can be made."
Before the Accords were formed, this woman had not been on the land for more than 30 years. Arabella leaned into Anna as she spoke, and Anna's scarred fingers drifted nimbly through the waves of the mermaid's hair. Tiny fish, small as sparks from a fire and bright blue, stirred when disturbed and leaped from strand to strand, chasing Anna's movements.
"My lovely, your hair is like a beautiful stream," murmured Anna, "because there are fish in it."
Apparently Anna could seduce multiple people in one evening. Arabella blushed and bounced up to gather more drinks from the sideboard.
"We know why Anna brought you, Matthew," said Malcolm. "You are amusing. But is there a reason this young Carstairs girl is accompanying you tonight?"
"Because we need your help," said Cordelia.
Everyone in the room laughed. Malcolm smiled and raised his empty glass to Cordelia as if she had made a particularly good joke. Arabella was still at the sideboard, sprinkling flowers into two flutes of wine and humming. Anna and Matthew looked pained.
Magnus Bane would help them, said Hypatia, the stars in her eyes sparkling. That is why they have come. Magnus has made them believe a warlock will always help them.
Magnus is not here, said Malcolm. His gaze was distant. I bear you no ill will, child, but I loved a shadow hunter once, and it brought me only sorrow.
She became an iron sister and broke his heart, said Hypatia.
Oh, said Cordelia, surprised. The iron sisters were even more secretive than the silent brothers. Stern and removed, they shaped Adamus into runed weapons for the Nephilim from their hidden fortress. They had done so for 1,000 years. Like the Silent Brothers, they did not marry and held the responsibility of placing protective spells on Shadowhunter babies when they were born. No one not of their sisterhood was allowed in the Adamant Citadel. Only women could choose to be Iron Sisters, though it seemed as lonely to Cordelia as Silent Brotherhood.
That seems very sad.
Indeed, said Malcolm. Our kind and yours are best apart, whatever Bane might say.
I have not met Bane, said Hypatia, tapping her golden fingernails together. Before he last left London, he helped the Nephilim, but they do not recall his graciousness, or do they only expect help at the first sign of trouble? I let you come to my salon because you amuse me, Matthew Fairchild, because you are a child, a silly and beautiful child, who touches the fire because it is lovely and forgets that it will burn him. Do not presume that means you can ask for favours.
It might be amusing for you to find out what it is they want, suggested Anna.
As if you don't already know, said Hypatia. But the look she gave Anna was a fond one, and Anna smiled.
What if we did something for you? Cordelia said.
Arabella was making the rounds, setting her flower-bedecked drinks in front of the warlocks. Malcolm lifted his and eyed it as if he were hoping to find solace at the bottom. Hastily, Cordelia said,
What if I saved your lives?
This time they didn't laugh. They simply stared.
Charming, Hypatia said, but we are not in any danger.
I disagree, said Cordelia.
She drew Cortana. Every glittering light in the room caught fire along the blade. Cordelia struck Hypatia's crystal flute with a sweep of her blade. The flute exploded, sending glass and wine in all directions. Arabella gave an indignant scream, and Cordelia swung the sword to point directly at her.
It's a pity, Cordelia said. I've never met a mermaid before. I wish you hadn't turned out to be a poisoner.
Matthew, who had already drained his glass, set it down on the table with a loud thump.
Poison?
Only for the warlocks, said Cordelia. It was them she was trying to kill.
Hypatia sounded outraged.
May I ask where you came to this wild conclusion?
My mother knows a great deal about medicinal plants, and she shared her knowledge with me, said Cordelia. There is a plant cultivated by the mermaids, an underwater variety of deadly nightshade, which they will not sell even at the shadow markets. One taste is death. I saw her sprinkle those blossoms in your cups.
Malcolm Fade waved a hand over his own cup. Purple sparks woke and danced in his glass. The red wine stain on the carpet unfurled like a flower and turned to purple smoke. Hypatia looked at the broken flute as if it had turned into a rat. I was a child in Cornwall long ago, where a Tropa belladonna grows wild, said Malcolm quietly. I am an expert in the uses of deadly nightshade, and I have seen its cousin, deadly nightsea, before. Miss Carstairs is right. She has saved our lives.
Seize the mermaid, Hypatia said between her teeth.
Anna was already up and out of her chair, dagger in hand, her movements light as a cat's. Arabella was fumbling in her bodice, her teeth bared, but Anna caught at her wrist, twisting it hard. An item fell from Arabella's fingers and rolled upon the golden carpet. It was the horn of a sea creature, sharpened to a deadly point.
"Let me end my life," Arabella hissed, writhing, but Anna continued to hold her prisoner with an arm about her neck.
Runes flared along Anna's bare, slender arm. The dagger in her other hand glimmered like diamonds.
"Let me die with honour as sea people do." "Honour? There is no honour in poison. It is a coward's trick," said Hypatia. "You intended to poison me and Malcolm Fade. And to what end? What power do you seek?"
"She seeks revenge," said Malcolm. "I have heard of you, Arabella. You considered yourself insulted by the Nephilim years ago. It must have been a much greater matter than any of us realized, for when Hypatia told you that they were here tonight, you sought to pay them back." His eyes narrowed. "Hypatia and I would have been dead. Warlocks poisoned by shadow hunters, you would claim. Every downworlder in London would have been after Nephilim blood."
Her face like stone, Hypatia picked up a small golden bell and shook it. The ringing echoed through the room. A blue-skinned fairy girl with foxgloves in her hair popped her head in through the door.
"You rang, mistress?"
Hypatia's mouth was a tight line.
"Hyacinth, have the guards take this mermaid away and put her in the wine cellar."
"Please reconsider putting a poisoner in the wine cellar," said Matthew. "I beg of you, for the sake of my future visits."
Hypatia waved a hand.
"Put her in the whispering room, then. She shouldn't be able to cause any trouble there. We'll take her to the spiral labyrinth shortly."
"And then?" said Cordelia, as two trolls wearing coats with gold braid entered, detached Arabella from Anna's grip, and escorted the hissing mermaid out of the room.
"What happens to her?"
"A trial," said Hypatia. "A downworlder matter of no interest to you. It will be fair. Downworlders are always fair."
"Then you should have little issue with offering Cordelia assistance," said Anna, brushing dust from her cuffs, "as she saved your life." "Anna is right," said Malcolm. "A debt is a debt. What is it you wish for help with, Nephilim?"
Cordelia let Matthew tell the tale. The picnic, James's vision of the Shadow Realm, the demons who came in daylight, the wounded shadow hunters, and the poison the Silent Brothers could not cure.
"Your friend saw a shadowland nobody else can see," said Hypatia. "Is he the child of the shape-changing warlock girl, and the shadow hunter mad enough to marry her? I knew that would be trouble."
Matthew looked furious.
Cordelia said, "He can indeed see what others cannot. It is a rare talent."
"So this is a kind of demon that comes in daylight," said Malcolm, "and transmits a poison your scholars have never seen before. If such demons were free in London, it would not be good for anyone," said Anna.
"Of course, all demons come from other worlds," said Hypatia. "But if you think that as the children of demons we are intimately familiar with their geography and those who dwell in them, you are quite mistaken."
"We are not insulting you, Miss Vex," said Cordelia, "but you have your ear to the ground of Downworld. Nothing happens in it that you do not know. If there was other word of these strange demons—"
"There is not," Hypatia said firmly. "All discussion has been about the lack of demons in London, in fact, and how strange it is."
"Ragnar called it the calm before the storm, but he is a doomsayer at the best of times," said Malcolm. "Well, they seem to be returning," said Anna. "A cluster of Shaxx demons appeared in Seven Dials just the other day."
"And Dumas demons were encountered in the city," Matthew added. "Nasty, messy sorts of creatures."
Hypatia and Malcolm exchanged a look. Demons were everyone's problem, downworlders and shadow hunters alike.
A single attack against shadowhunters by unknown creatures was one thing, but Shax and Dumas demons were indiscriminate killers. There was a rumour, said Malcolm, though it was only a rumour, mind, that some sort of powerful individual, a warlock perhaps, put out the word among the demon groups that London was to be avoided.
Since when have demons ever listened to anyone? Inquired Anna.
Malcolm shrugged. As I said, a rumour. Besides, in such a situation, it seems wise to leave well enough alone.
The time for leaving well enough alone has passed, said Cordelia. These sunlight demons may be a harbinger of worse to come for us all. Surely we should work together to discover if that is the case.
I detest it when shadow hunters make sense, Hypatia sighed. Ragnar Fell is back in London, and he has often worked with shadow hunters in the past. He knows a great deal about demon worlds, having made himself a student of dimensional magic. If there is a dimension that breeds demons who can withstand sunlight, he would know about it.
It does seem a place to start. How do we find him? Said Matthew.
I will send him an urgent message, said Hypatia. He will contact you.
She sank back into her chair. Now go, she said, closing her starry eyes.
I find myself weary of angels.
There seemed little else to say. Matthew, Anna, and Cordelia made their way back through the main room of the salon, where a vampire was reciting poetry about blood. In moments they had reached Berwick Street and the outside world. Cordelia inhaled lungfuls of cool night air. It tasted of dirt and city.
Nephilim!
It was the blue-skinned fairy girl Hypatia had called Hyacinth. She looked around at the city in distaste before handing Matthew a velvet-wrapped bundle.
Fade wished you to have this, she said. He is grateful for what you all did.
What did you do?
She added curiously.
I've never heard of a warlock being grateful before.
Anna winked at her. I'll tell you the story in a moment. Cordelia and Matthew looked at Anna in surprise. Hyacinth blushed and giggled her way back down the alley.
I'm going to linger a bit longer, Anna said with a cat-like stretch. You two can take the carriage. I'll make my own way home.
Matthew pulled back a corner of the velvet. Folded gently within were perhaps a half dozen blades of fine and careful fairy workmanship. Matthew whistled. A real gift. He looked at Cordelia with admiration, his bronze hair gleaming in the naphtha light.
I would never have guessed Arabella was engaged in poisoning. I told you earlier, said Anna, gesturing for the carriage. I never do court dull girls.
Days passed. Paris, 1902.
You must go to Paris, Matthew had said to Thomas the day before Thomas left for Madrid.
He, James, and Matthew were sprawled in their chairs in the Devil Tavern, waiting for Christopher.
If you are finally getting to flee this dull island for someplace cultured, you must go to Paris first.
It's not on the way to Spain, Thomas had said, and that will be plenty of excitement for me.
Nonsense, said Matthew. Only Paris is like Paris, and you must stay in my absolutely favourite digs, the Hôtel d'Alsace, on the left bank. Everyone calls it l'hôtel.
Doesn't that just mean the hotel in French? James had said, barely looking up from his book.
That's because it's the hotel where anybody who is anybody stays.
I'm not anybody, Thomas had protested.
Oscar Wilde stayed there, said James. When Matthew says anybody, that's usually who he means.
Not only Oscar Wilde, Matthew had said, but yes, Oscar Wilde. He died there.
I trust you'll have a more pleasant time, said James.
Thomas really had intended to confine his travels to Spain, but Matthew's words had stuck with him, and when the head of the Madrid Institute had suggested that Thomas take 2 weeks off to see a bit more of the world, Thomas had recalled Matthew's promises that the whole world would be changed in his eyes after he had beheld the City of Lights. L'hôtel felt like being in someone's home, albeit someone a bit scruffy. It was in the 6th arrondissement, which on the whole had a friendly but slightly shabby feeling. It was full of mundanes who were attending the Sorbonne nearby, and Thomas found it easy to feel part of the crowd as he strode the neighbourhood streets at sunset, thinking about where to dine. He declined to check in with the Paris Institute, saw only a bare handful of downworlders, and set out to enjoy himself. Unfortunately, Thomas had grown used to being in easy reach of his closest friends, and even the Madrid Institute was a lively place where company was always close at hand. The solitude quickly began to wear on him. Here he knew no one and spoke essentially none of the language. Whole days passed where his only conversation was with a waiter or a museum employee or the desk clerk at L'Hôtel. He grew lonely, and in his loneliness he grew bored. He dutifully went to the Louvre and had thoughts about what he saw, but nobody to share them with. He wrote them down in a notebook and wondered if he would ever look at it again. He counted the days until he returned to Spain, wondering how to tell Matthew that the city itself was not enough of a companion to satisfy him. And then, unaccountably, he saw someone he knew. Not a friend. Alistair Carstairs was definitely not a friend, but more than an acquaintance, surely. They'd been at the academy together, where Carstairs had been, not to put too fine a point on it, awful. He'd been one of the mean boys, the ones who played cruel and dangerous pranks, the ones who identified any other boy's quality that stood out and made sure to hammer it down with the force of their contempt and their laughter. In Thomas's case, that had been his size. He was short for his age and narrow-shouldered, and he looked younger than he was. Of course, that had been years ago. Thomas now towered above most people. In fact, he only spotted Alistair because he could see over the heads of the crowd between them. Matthew had directed Thomas to Librairie Galignani on the Rue de Rivoli as a must-see location. "It's the oldest English-language bookshop on the whole continent," Matthew had said. Thomas lingered over books of poetry, allowing himself to take a long time to decide what to buy, and then Alistair appeared. Thomas hadn't decided yet whether to acknowledge Alistair, but he wasn't given much choice. Alistair was staring directly at him. As Thomas watched, Alistair's face went through a series of expressions. Mild recognition, confusion, shock, exasperation, long-suffering forbearance. Thomas gave him a little wave. Alistair pushed his way through the people between them. "By the angel, Lightwood," he said, "you've become gigantic." Thomas raised his eyebrows. A few other people nearby did as well. "This is your revenge, I suppose," Alistair went on, as if Thomas had done this to him personally. "For all the times I called you wee little Thomas, or half pint, or... I can't remember. I'm sure I had something cutting and witty to say." "What are you doing in Paris?" Thomas said. "What are you doing in Paris?" Alistair said back in a superior tone, as though he'd caught Thomas at something. "I'm on holiday from my travel year in Spain." Alistair nodded. A silence fell. Thomas began to panic. They were not friends. What Thomas knew about Alistair was mostly negative. He did not know what his duties were here. He was thinking of ways to politely excuse himself, perhaps by fleeing the bookstore and returning some hours later when Alistair spoke up. "Do you want to come to the Louvre, then? I'm going over there after this." Thomas could have said, "I've already been, thanks," or, "Actually, I have a pressing lunch engagement." But he didn't. He had been alone for days. He said, "All right." So they went. It was crowded, and Alistair was grumpy about it, but he didn't take it out on Thomas. He didn't belittle the art. He didn't speak in rapturous tones either. To Thomas's surprise, Alistair seemed content to place himself before a work of art and simply behold it for a long moment, letting it wash over his senses. His face was serious, his brow wrinkled, but Thomas was sure that it was the most content he had ever seen Alistair. For his part, Thomas had visited this very museum and had assembled a number of, he thought, insightful observations about a number of pieces. He shared a few of these with Alistair, tentatively. He waited for Alistair to scoff, but Alistair just acknowledged Thomas's comments with a nod. Thomas had no reason to like Alistair, had, in fact, every reason to dislike Alistair. But in these small moments, standing next to one another in the presence of a beautiful object, he was glad Alistair was there, and Alistair's acknowledgement of him, however small, made him feel better than he had since he'd arrived in Paris. Maybe he had changed, Thomas thought. Maybe everyone grew up sooner or later. Maybe he had not even been that bad in the first place. He thought back to his time at the academy and decided that, no, Alistair had definitely been terrible in the first place, but he seemed calmer now, more thoughtful. After they left the museum, Thomas and Alistair went for a walk along the Seine. Alistair wanted to know all about Madrid, and Thomas was even able to rise some stories from Alistair about his time in Damascus and Morocco and Paris itself. Having grown up in Idris and London, Thomas felt that Alistair must be very worldly. And yet he wondered if so much relocation would make a person lonely. The Eiffel Tower rose in front of them, and Alistair gestured at it. Have you been up there yet?
I have, Thomas answered. The view is stunning.
What do you think of the view from here? Alistair asked. Thomas had the distinct feeling that a trap was being laid for him, but he wasn't sure why or how to avoid stepping into it.
I think it's a fascinating structure, he said. There's nothing like it.
Alistair gave a mirthless chuckle. Indeed there isn't. In fact, many Parisians are horrified by it. They find it ugly, hideous even, and they call it Eiffel's folly. Thomas looked up at the tower again. The sun was sinking, burnishing the metal with an orange-pink glow. For a moment, it put him in mind of the soaring Adamus towers that protected the shadow hunter capital of Alicante, the way they caught the light of the setting sun and held it a little longer than one expected. It isn't ugly, he said. It's just unusual. Alistair looked satisfied. Quite right. Gustav Eiffel is a genius, and I feel certain he shall one day be appreciated. Sometimes you have to stand back and let people do what they are good at, even if it seems like madness at the time. They had dinner together at a bistro nearby, which Thomas thought was fairly decent, but Alistair described as indifferent. They talked late into the night. They closed down the restaurant while everyone else left, and they were still talking about books, travel, music, history. Thomas told Alistair that he planned to get a tattoo of a compass rose on the inside of his arm. He hadn't told anyone else that, and Alistair seemed curious. Where on your arm? He asked. And when Thomas showed him, Alistair ran his fingers over the spot, unself-consciously, his fingertips tracing a path from the sensitive skin of Thomas's inner wrist to the crook of his elbow. Thomas sat stunned and shivering, though he was hot all over. Alistair didn't seem to notice, only took his hand back and asked the waiter for the bill, which he paid. Alistair refused to tell Thomas where he was staying, but he told Thomas to meet him at a certain address the next afternoon for a surprise. 15 minutes after the meeting time, Thomas decided that Alistair was not coming and was probably somewhere laughing about it, but Alistair did in fact appear, and even apologised for his lateness. He led Thomas to the doors of the Théâtre Robert Houdin.
I know we're supposed to avoid mundane things,
said Alistair, but you must see this. It's a film, a moving picture. This one is the latest. It's called Le Voyage dans la Lune. Even Thomas could translate this. And for 17 minutes, they marvel together at what the mundanes had done, made pictures move, like a theatre, but in images projected onto a screen. There was a narrator who, Thomas supposed, told the story, but he couldn't follow it at all. He enjoyed it anyway, watching these mundanes in their strange costumes climb into a large metal box like an artillery shell, go to the moon, and be chased away by strange creatures already living there. "Do you think it's real?" he said to Alistair as they walked out, blinking in the sudden light of the daytime. "What? No, don't be stupid," Alistair said, pushing a lock of dark hair behind his ears. People always fussed over blonde hair, like Matthew's, as if it was special. But privately, Thomas thought dark hair and eyes were much more striking. "It's like a play or a magic trick. That's what mundanes do. They can't do magic, so they play tricks that look like magic. But it isn't really." Alistair said goodbye to him at the end of the lane. He said he was leaving Paris the next day, but he continued to refuse to tell Thomas why he was there, or where he was going, or why he was leaving the next day. Thomas supposed that they weren't, after all, friends, though he had enjoyed the time they'd spent together. He wasn't fully sure what a friend was, if it wasn't someone you enjoyed spending time with. The whole trip had seemed disconnected and dreamlike. Alistair had come from nowhere and now returned to nowhere, and Thomas had no idea when they would next see each other, or how they would act when they did. Were they now friends? Had they been friends these past few days? "I return to Spain in a couple of days myself," Thomas said. Alistair gave a little chuckle. "It's odd that you came here from Madrid, like taking a vacation from a vacation." "I suppose," said Thomas. Then he frowned. "No, it isn't odd. A travel year isn't a vacation, it's an assignment to a post. Do you have to snipe at everything?" Alistair looked startled. "I'm sorry," he said after a long moment. "I don't mean anything by it." He seemed worried in that moment, and human, and vulnerable in a way that made Thomas want to... Well, he wasn't sure what he wanted to do, but he stuck out his hand to Alistair, who stared at it for a moment, then slowly took it. His hand was warm and calloused against Thomas's, and Thomas remembered the feel of Alistair's fingers on the inside of his arm and tried not to change expression. They shook. Alistair had not asked Thomas about his friends or his family. Thomas hadn't asked Alistair either. For these days, it had been as though nobody else existed in the entire world. "Well," Thomas said, "goodbye, Carstairs. Goodbye, Lightwood. Try not to get any taller. You're starting to be off-putting in the other direction." Thomas watched Alistair walk away and waited for him to turn around one last time. But Alistair never looked back as he turned the corner and disappeared. Ten. Loyalty binds. Close, side by side from morn till night, kissing and dalliance their delight. Whilst thou from human solace flying, with unrequited love art dying. Nizami Ganjavi, Leila and Majnun. The proprietor would not let Lucy up to the Merry Thieves' private rooms at the Devil Tavern, so she was reduced to sending a message through Polly, the werewolf barmaid. She sat in an uncomfortable wooden chair and fumed, as a mixture of downworlders and magicians stared at her curiously, a small, bonneted girl with Nephilim runes, clutching an axe. In the corner, a Kelpie who seemed to be marinating in a tank of gin gave her a beady look. "Drain of pale?" inquired a wild-haired vampire, offering her a half-drunk bottle of gin. She doesn't drink. It was Thomas, glowering. The vampire shrank back. Christopher appeared at Thomas's shoulder, blinking.
I knew you'd be here, said Lucy triumphantly.
We very nearly weren't, said Christopher. We decided to use the laboratory upstairs instead of at Grosvenor Square, since Matthew and James weren't going to be here to be bothered or blown up. Thomas shushed him. Christopher, enough. Lucy, what's going on? Did something happen? After dragging the two of them outside, Lucy did her best to explain the situation without mentioning Jessie. She blamed Jessamine instead, and a gossip network between ghosts that she had invented on the spot. Fortunately, neither Christopher nor Thomas was the suspicious type. We need Matthew, and he's bloody gone off to Anna's, said Thomas, after telling her the little they knew. The letter that had come for James at Matthew's house, his determination to meet Grace, the time of the meeting set for 10 o'clock. He'll know where James has gone. James said it was where the two of them used to practice balance. But what if we're too late? Said Christopher, vibrating with anxiety. Lucy checked the clock that hung before the church of St. Dunstan in the West, across the dark line of Fleet Street. They were quite near the Institute here. She could see its distinctive spire rising above the roofs of London.
9 o'clock, she said. One of you must have a carriage. We'll go to Anna's.
Which was how they found themselves a quarter of an hour later on Percy Street, Thomas helping Lucy down from his family's Victoria. The street was full of pedestrians, though there were lights on in many windows. Lucy made out a shape sitting on Anna's stairs in the dark. She felt no surprise. Ladies were always making cakes of themselves on Anna's doorstep. Then Lucy made out broad shoulders on the silhouette and realized that the person on Anna's doorstep was a man. He bolted upright, and the lights from the arc lamps fell on him. On Percy Street, the streetlights were older and less reliable, their fierce yellow burns stripping the world down to harsh lines. Lucy saw bright hair and a scowling face.
Alistair?
Thomas sounded astonished. Christopher groaned as Alistair Carstairs raced down the street toward them, a whirlwind in an unbuttoned towncoat. Beneath the coat, his waistcoat was disarranged, and one side of his high wingtip collar was askew.
You've lost your hat, Alistair, said Lucy.
Alistair said, I have lost my sister. Lucy went cold.
What do you mean? Has something happened to Cordelia?
I don't bloody know, do I? Said Alistair. I let her go take tea with Anna Lightwood, and now I return to pick her up at the agreed-upon time, and they are both gone. I should never have left her alone with...
Be very careful what you say about Anna, said Christopher.
Lucy thought she ought to have found it funny. Christopher, who was never angry, speaking in those icy tones to Alistair. But somehow, it was not funny at all. Alistair advanced upon Christopher dangerously, but Thomas caught his arm as he went by. Lucy watched with great satisfaction as Alistair was brought to a complete standstill, without Thomas having to exert any particular effort. The muscles of Alistair's arm tensed beneath his coat sleeve as he strained against Thomas's grip. Alistair was tall enough and looked strong enough, but he couldn't make any headway.
Steady, Alistair, said Thomas. I know you're worried about your sister. We are worried about James. Better we discuss setting matters right than brawl in public.
Alistair tilted his chin to meet Thomas's eyes, the line of his jaw a hard slash.
Let me loose, he snarled, and cease constantly addressing me by my first name. You are not a scrubby schoolboy trailing after me any longer.
Thomas, his cheeks flaming red, whipped his hand back as if he had been burned.
Stop it, Lucy snapped.
Thomas had only been trying to be kind.
Matthew is most likely with Anna and Cordelia. He can chaperone.
Alistair's expression went flat.
You think I would be relieved to hear she's with Matthew?
You think I don't know a drunk when I see one? Believe me, I do. If he puts Cordelia in harm's way...
There was the sudden and welcome rattle of wheels on Stony Road. They all whirled to see the consul's carriage rolling up to Anna's house. The carriage door opened and disgorged Cordelia and Matthew, who was holding a rolled-up piece of velvet. The two of them froze at the sight of the visitors.
"What are you doing here?" Matthew said. "Has something happened to Barbara and the others?"
"No," Thomas said hastily. "Nothing like that. But it is urgent. James is in danger." James walked through the night from the King's Road toward the Thames. Matthew had often taken him on impromptu tours of Chelsea, past Queen Anne-style buildings with their grand sweeps of stone steps and terracotta panels turning gold in the sunshine, pointing out the residences of famous poets and artists who had lived scandalous lives. Now the lit windows of the houses shone dimly through a heavy mist, which grew heavier as James approached the river. The riverside at Chelsea Embankment was a promenade under plane trees heavy with leaves, visible only as dark clouds above James's head, their wet trunks illuminated by the ghostly globes of the cast-iron lampposts that lined the river's edge. The Thames, beyond the river wall, was barely distinguishable in the thick fog. Only the sound of a petrol-powered police boat chugging past and the gleams of a bobby's lantern on its wake betrayed the river's presence. James was early. He started walking slowly toward the arch of Battersea Bridge, trying to quell his impatience and worry.
Grace. He recalled their kiss in the park, the inchoate agony that had risen up inside him, as if he were being stabbed through with a needle.
A premonition of demons, perhaps, the unknown danger so close, the shadow realm just touching this one. It was hard to know, but then it was hard to know anything that had to do with Grace. There were times when he thought of her that he felt such pain that all his bones seemed strung on a single wire, and he imagined that if the wire was pulled taut, it would kill him.
"How much is love meant to hurt?" he had asked his father once.
"Oh, terribly," his father had said with a smile. "But we suffer for love because love is worth it."
Suddenly she was there, as if she had appeared between one moment and another, standing beneath an ornate triple-headed lamppost at the near end of the bridge, a small misty figure in the fog, dressed as she always was in light colours, her face a pale moon in the lamplight. James broke into a run, and she dashed down the steps of the bridge toward where he stood on the embankment. When they reached each other, she threw her arms around him. Her hands were cool against the back of his neck, and he felt dizzy and assailed by memories. The crumbling walls of Blackthorn Manor, the shadows in the forest where they'd sat and talked together, her hand fastening the silver bracelet around his wrist. James drew away enough to look down into her face.
"What happened?" he said.
"Your letter said you were in danger." She dropped a hand now to circle his wrist, her fingers sliding over the band of metal, as if to make sure it was still there. Her fingers pressed against his pulse point.
"Mama is mad with rage. I don't know what she will do. She told Charles..."
"I know what she told Charles," he said. "Please tell me you were not worried about me, Grace."
"You came to the house to see me," she said. "Did you know that Cordelia was there?"
He hesitated. How could he say that he hadn't come to the house to see her? That there had been a moment, a terrible moment, when Cordelia had mentioned that Grace was in the house and he'd realised he had not thought of her. How was it possible to feel such agony when someone's name was mentioned, yet forget them in duress? He recalled Jem having told him that stress could do terrible things to one's mind. Surely that was all it was.
"I didn't know until I arrived and saw her and Lucy," he said. "I gather they wanted to see that you were all right. When I came, I heard noises in the greenhouse and..." He broke off with a shrug. He hated lying to Grace. I saw the demon.
You were being brave, I know, but Mama does not see it that way. She thinks you came only to humiliate her and remind the world of her father's misdeeds.
James badly wanted to kick a lamppost.
Let me talk to her. We could sit down, all of us, my father and you and your mother.
James!
Grace looked almost furious for a moment.
What my mother would do to me if I even suggested such a thing?
She shook her head.
No. She watches everything I do. I was barely able to get out tonight. I had thought that coming to London might soften her toward you, but she has become harder than ever. She says the last time Herondales were at Chiswick House, her father and husband died. She says she will not let you destroy us.
Tatiana is utterly mad, James thought helplessly. He had not realized it had gone so much beyond spite.
Grace, what are you saying? She says she will bring me back to Idris, that she was wrong to let me attend parties and events that you and your sister would be at, and the Lightwoods. She says that I will be corrupted and ruined. She will lock me away, James, for the next 2 years. I will not see you, not be able to write to you.
That is the danger you meant, he said softly. He understood. Such loneliness would seem like danger to Grace. It would seem like death.
Then come to us at the Institute, he said. The Institute is there to provide sanctuary to Nephilim in distress. My parents are kind people. We would protect you from her.
Grace shook her head hard enough to dislodge her small, flower-trimmed hat.
My mother would only petition to have the Clave return me to her, and they would do it as I am not 18 yet.
You don't know that. My parents have influence within the Clave.
If you truly love me, she said, her grey eyes flaring, then you will marry me. Now. We must elope. If we were mundanes, we could run to Gretna Green and marry, and nothing could tear us apart. I would belong to you and not to her.
James was stunned.
But we are not mundanes.
Their marriage ceremony would not be considered valid by the Clave.
Marry me in a shadow hunter ceremony, Grace. You don't need her permission. We cannot do that, Grace protested. We cannot remain in the shadow hunter world where my mother can reach us. We must escape her influence, her ability to punish us. We must be married in Gretna, and if needs be, we will let our marks be stripped.
Let our marks be stripped? James went cold all over. Having your marks stripped was the most severe punishment a shadow hunter could endure. It meant exile and becoming a mundane. He tried to imagine never seeing his parents again, or Lucy, or Christopher, or Thomas. Having the bond that tied him to Matthew severed, like having his right hand sliced off. Becoming a mundane and losing everything that made him a shadow hunter.
Grace, no, that isn't the answer. It isn't the answer for you, she said coolly, for you have always been a shadow hunter. I have never been trained, never borne but a few marks. I know nothing of the history. I have no warrior partner, nor friends. I might as well have been raised a mundane.
In other words, said James, you will be losing nothing, and I would be losing everything. Grace stepped out of James's arms. Pain took her place, the ache of being without her. It was physical, inexpressible, and unexplainable. It was simple what it was. When she was not there, he felt it like a wound.
You would not be losing me, said Grace.
I don't want to lose you, he said, as steadily as he could through the pain.
But we have only to wait a little while, and we can be together without also losing everything else. You don't understand, Grace cried. You can't. You don't know.
Then tell me.
What is it? What don't I know?
Her voice was hoarse.
I must have you do this for me, James, she said. I must. It is so important. More than you can know. Only say you will. Only say it.
It seemed almost as if she were begging him to say it, even if he did not mean it. But what would be the point of that? No, she must want him to mean it, to be willing to do it, risk the end of the only life he knew, risk never seeing any of those he loved again. He closed his eyes and saw, against the backs of his eyelids, the faces of his parents. His sister, Jem, Thomas, Christopher, Matthew. Matthew, who he would be damaging in a way that might never be repaired. He struggled to say the words, to shape them. When he finally spoke, his voice was as hoarse as if he had been screaming. No, I cannot do it. He saw her flinch back.
This is because you did not come to Idris, she said, her lips trembling. At the beginning of the summer, you forgot me.
I could never have forgotten you. Not after weeks, or months, or years, Grace.
Any man would marry me, she went on. Any man would do this if I asked him. But not you. You have to be different.
Her mouth twisted.
You are made of different stuff than other men.
James flung up a hand in protest.
Grace, I do want to marry you. Not enough.
She took a step back from him. Then her eyes widened suddenly, and she screamed. James's body moved faster than thought. He flung himself at Grace, and they both hit the pavement hard. Grace gasped and pressed herself against the river wall as a demon shot past them, a hairbreadth away. And it was a demon. A dark, twisted shape like a mangled tree root, eyeless and noseless, but with thorn-sharp brown teeth, its body coated with black slime. It had no wings, but long, bent legs like a frog's. It sprang at them again, and this time James yanked a blade from his belt and flung it. Runes flashed across the blade like fire as it sailed through the air and struck, nearly blowing apart the demon's chest. Ichor splattered, and it vanished back to its own dimension. Grace had scrambled to her feet. He pulled her up the steps and onto the bridge for a better vantage point.
A Cerberus demon, she said, blinking. But it was dead. The one in the greenhouse was dead. That's why I thought I could leave.
She sucked in her breath.
Oh, God, there are more of them coming.
She thrust out her hands as if she could push them away. They were coming, indeed. Dark shapes were appearing through the fog from the middle of the bridge, crawling and leaping like hellish frog monsters, slithering and slipping across the wet road. As one hopped toward them, it shot out a long, black, sticky tongue, snatched up an unfortunate pigeon, and deposited the bird into its fanged mouth. James fired off throwing knives, one, two, three times. Every time a demon fell. He pressed a knife into Grace's hand, his eyes entreating her. She backed up against the railing of the bridge, the blade gripped in her shaking hand. A demon reached for her and she stabbed out. It made an eerie howling sound as black-red ichor streamed from its shoulder. It hopped away from her, hissing and lunged again. She ducked. James flung a knife and destroyed